This is November the 5th, 1960, at Fairbanks, Alaska, and we're in Mr. Tong Long's house at 1034 6th Street. And now Mr. Long will introduce Mr. Patty Savage on the tape.
Go ahead, Patty. You go ahead. Say what year you came into the country. And
your name is Patrick Savage.
Yeah.
Your full name?
Yeah, my name is Savage, yes.
Patrick.
Hi, Patrick. Patrick, yeah.
Give your full name, Patrick.
Huh?
Give your full name.
Patrick, yeah. Patrick Savage. Mm-hmm. Well, I came into the country in 1914, into Nome, in the Victoria.
Can we go back a little further and when you were born, Patty, and where you come from?
Well, I was born in a little place outside of Ardfert, County Kerry, Ireland. A little place called College Field. It belonged to Trinity College Dublin. There was only 23 Irish acres in it. And it was the only piece of property around there that belonged to the Trinity College. And the next location, right close to the boundaries, was called Brandon Well, belonged to the Crosby Estate. That was the Billy Crosby, was called Billy the Leveler, because he leveled about 300 or 400 homes around the village there. And when I, the reason I came, I was always thinking of coming to Alaska anyway. When I was about 9 or 10 years old, I figured in coming to Alaska. It took me a long time to get there, but eventually I got there, yes. And the reason why, you might have known him as Standish O'Sullivan.
Standish.
Yeah. He came here when I was about to Alaska when I was 9 or 10 years old. He was not related to me, but his cousins, his first cousins were. See, his uncle was married to my mother's first cousin, see. So we were the that family, and we were related. But that was I always had it in my mind to come to Alaska. Then I came, when I left the old country, I left in 1907. In September, I think.
Yeah, speak a little louder.
Probably in September. About the 16th of September. How I happened to come, I was, that's the fall of the year, and that the harvest is almost done, see. And I was at a neighbor's place building a rick of hay, a rick of straw from a threshing machine. And the first cousin of mine come along and he says, come on, let us go to the States. And I says, all right, okay. So I went home, changed, got dressed, and hit for Queenstown. Then when I got to Queenstown, we couldn't get on the boat. We had to wait there for about a week or so, maybe a week or 10 days. We traveled around a little from there. And I wrote home that we had left, you know. And that, so did he, that we had left in that place, and that nobody would come after you to get back. We were skipping. So then I came to a place called Waterbury, and there was a depression on at that time, in 1907. Very slack time. By gosh, we got a job in a few days, we got a job in the same factory, which was a little ways out of the town of Waterbury. It was inside the city limits yet, just on the bound of city limits. Smith and Griggs, small factory, and we were glad to get it. Worked for $1.50 an hour, not an hour. Mm-hmm. And we were dang glad to get it. And we worked there for considerable time. I worked there for something over a year. Then I left there and I went to work for a wire mill. And packaging and shipping, see. And the head shipping clerk and I, we couldn't get along. So I quit. Then I went to work in Scoble's blacksmith shop, And I worked there for a considerable time. And that didn't suit me very well. Then I worked for the Cody Packing Company, delivering meat, you know. And from that I went in with the insurance, I worked for John Hancock Insurance Company. I worked with them for about a year, and then I skipped out of there to come to California. That was in 1911.
Was that J.H. Hancock?
J.H., yeah.
I worked for him also.
Good enough. Good outfit to work for.
I worked for the construction company in Hollywood, California, later mm-hmm. years, around 1918.
Well, mm-hmm. I guess that was quite a little while after.
Yeah.
So I come down to come to California then, and I went to work in a pipe mill there, making steel pipe. And I worked there for some time. Then I went to attend a bar for 2 years there. And then I took out, and I and another sister got and come for Alaska.
1914?
No, in 14, yeah.
1914?
Spring of 14, yeah. So we come to...
How did you manage your transportation to Nome?
Well, the manager paid you. We paid it for transportation. So we come by boat to Alaska, you know.
Victoria.
After Seattle, I mean, and then by the Victoria from Seattle to Nome. And we were held up outside of Nome for 2 or 3 days in the ice. So with the first boat in, see.
How many years were you in Nome, Teddy?
I was in Nome only 4 or 5 months. That was the deal before, you know, Nome. There was a big storm in Nome, and the whole front was washed out. The heating plant by Sesson was washed out, and the plant down at Fort Davis was washed out. So I went to work for, in Nome, it was very hard to go to work there then. I went to work for a fellow that was building the, remodeling the Wesson Sesson's plant there, you know. He was building it up again. I got a job making mortar, mixing it. Sand and lime and making mortar, and there wasn't another man in Nome hardly could do it.
He was the only plasterer then.
Yeah. And the union got after me, you know, and they wanted me to join the union. Well, I didn't want to join the union because I didn't figure there was me with that kind of that job, and it wouldn't last long, you know. And the boss told him, well, get me a man, he says, and I let him go. Get me a man that can do this work. They couldn't get a man that could do so. So I stayed there till I come up the river in the fall. In August, the end of August, I came up.
What stampede did you come to when you came up,
Teddy? Well, I went to Ruby. Yeah. I went to Ruby and I stayed in Ruby for a while. I didn't stay very long in Ruby, let's see. I got there in the fall of 14, yeah. We were coming up the Yukon River when war was declared.
Yeah, well, my dad was there.
Yeah, he was there, yes. And I left Ruby in 15 and went down the Yukon and up the Anoka to Dead Rod. Mm-hmm. And I stayed in Dead Rod from there until 54, spring of 54, very flat. Any more than a stampede, a little out of there. I was in the torture stampede for 5 or 6 months, running around. But that was then. Of course, when I came from.
Did you come over to the Beaver Stampede when they had the Beaver Stampede out below Portland?
No. Really, the only stampede I came to was the tall side, and I got enough of that. It's been a couple of years running after that for every winter. I spent 3 winters there, and didn't find anything either.
What creek was it that you mined in over there in?
Flat Creek.
Flat Creek.
Yeah. I started to mine in 23. And I mined until 31. Then I by hand, you know. Hand and water. Splash system and, you know, a pipeline too. Mm-hmm. And then we shut down. There was two other fellows with me, an Irishman and a Swede. Jimmy Green and Gus Rodman, two great big giants too. And we quit. The ground was clear out, and we quit. And then I didn't go back there until 35. I worked in the bridge for 2 years then, two summers, 31 and 32, or 30, yeah, 31, 32. Then 33, I made a trip to the old country. And come back and I left, of course, I went out here in 32 in the fall, you know, in the winter. I went over in the spring to the old country and come back in the middle of summer. Came back into flat again about in August. And the next year, I went to mine for myself again up to the creek. And I mined up there until 54. I quit in 53 up there and moved to Ruby, which was not a very good move.
You were doing better where you were.
Oh yeah. In 49, and I put an outfit up into Wild Lake. Cost me almost $100, cost me over $93,000 or $94,000. Of course I got $35,000 back out of it for some of the machinery.
Yeah.
And I lost the remainder. So then I was working the flat after that. And I lost a lot of money in Ruby Boy.
Yeah.
I made it in flat and lost everywhere I moved. That's the funny thing, you know. Before you walk away from it. But of course, flat was pretty well done when I left. But the fellows and boys are mining in the same ground now, and they've done pretty well this summer. Very well. What I consider very well, yes. But the life it is not much, and it's a very, very deep, rough ground, and they got the equipment to do it with. They got a 4-yard drag line there, and they got a washing plant, and everything like that. They can handle.
You have Al Burke's ground on Long.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I expect to do something like that someday.
Yeah, someday that'll
yeah.
pay some money.
And I may be able to sell the machinery I got there.
Mm-hmm.
I've got put a price on it now, a very, very meager price. $75,000.
Mm-hmm.
There's $250,000 worth of stuff there.
Yeah.
I got to know anybody that would take that. If they were a young man, he could take that and make money on it. Because he'll get at least $30,000 out of the ground there in royalty. And got a drag line there, a 2.5-yard line. That's worth $40,000. And I got out 1 8 that's new and true, old 8 8. I got 4 pumps, I got 3 or 4 sleeves, I got a welding plant, light plant, everything well equipped. Well equipped, but just I can't eat it, you know. But someday somebody will take hold of it.
What do you think about Trail Creek, Patty?
Well, it's got a chance. But it needs it's got a very good chance. There is a rich streak in Trail Creek, but it needs quite a considerable drilling.
Yeah.
That's what's bad about it. It's a tell before a man can go in there. Nowadays you can't go into something except there's you can something in sight, you know, where you can make a little. Trail Creek has got a chance.
How many claims has Albert there? Of that ground that you have?
Well, it's a two-claim association.
Two-claim association.
Three, and then there's a fraction that's almost as big as a claim.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 3/4 claim. And there's a couple of fractions there. Well, that's been quite a bit of ground, and I got a 30 inches from the windy bench.
Couldn't you work that ground, Patty?
Well, I could not yet.
Not yet.
Because they got it tied up there below me, see?
Mm-hmm.
Until they get to the line, I couldn't work it.
Mm-hmm.
I could, I guess, but then it should be difficult, see?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to do it anyway. I'm getting a little old for going mining again.
How old are you now, Patty?
79.
79?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're doing real good.
Doing all right so far. 79 the 30th of October. That's a few days ago.
Well, over in that area, was there anything that happened that you can tell us a little about? Sidelights to that country you mined in.
Well, Not anything about it in particular, you know. Not
how about the meat and the game and the fish? And
huh?
How about the meat and game and fish? And just
all oh, the well, the meat, a lot of moose. And, of course, there's a little fish in the streams, not very much. Grilling and little trout. But the moose is, see, they got all the moose they wanted this fall there. Mm-hmm. Everybody got a moose.
How about a garden? How does it grow?
Oh, the garden grows wonderful, but that such as potatoes and cabbage and celery and lettuce and carrots and all that kind of stuff.
Cabbage.
Cabbage. Oh, cabbage.
Celery.
Yeah. Oh, got a wonderful crop. And now Mary Olson down there, she got cabbage there. She had cabbage there about the 1st of July. Great big heads of cabbage, you know.
What is considered an average mining season in days in the country you live in?
Oh, about 100 days.
100 days season?
Yeah. That's preparing and, you know, yeah. Really from the 15th of May until the 1st of October. But, you know, for sluicing alone, you know, it's about 100 days sluicing, but the really, you got you can start to move the overburden in about the 15th of May, see. And you can stay with it until this year. You can stay with it until now if you wanted to. You can stay with it until the 1st of October anyway. About 130 days.
What was the population of Flat when you first came there, Patty?
Oh, about about 500.
500?
Yes.
And now what is it?
But it's about 5 now.
And I did rot as a ghost town.
It's a ghost town. There's not a soul there.
Yeah. All the interior towns are very much alike.
Yes, yes.
Dead.
When gone. I came into Flat, you know, first they said that the camp was worked out. They were giving up, it was worked out.
Yeah.
So there it is, it's going yet.
Yeah.
And it produced quite a bit this past summer. There are 3 outfits working there and they all made well.
What is the name of the 3 outfits?
The Miskoviches, the Fullerton brothers, and the Agoffs.
Are they Italian?
They're born in Flat, but the father's Russian, the mother's from one of the Dakotas. Oh, yes.
Donnelly and Shepherd, they had a bank there in the early days, didn't they?
Oh, yes, yeah. From not so very long ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that was not so very long ago.
Do you remember the Black Bear case?
Oh yeah, I sure do. Oh my, that was a great case.
You
didn't
tell
that
story.
Yeah, and the mail was robbed?
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah.
I was there. In fact, I could have been driving that mail train that winter.
Yeah. Duffy was
no,
there.
No, not Duffy, but Beatty. Beatty wanted me to take that team that Duffy was driving. And the father, I wouldn't take it. I wanted to go. I wanted to go prospecting. So if I took it, I'd be mixed up in that mail robbery probably.
Yeah. What was the name of that roadhouse now? That was
Shellmeyer's.
Shellmeyer's. Yeah.
You know, I was with the court when they came in that time when they investigated that. Pumped the shafts out and I found the locks and everything, see. I happened to be the year I got married. They had married Holy Cross.
The mail sack lock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Shelmer was, after spilling the beans, he was coming up with us. He was with them in the boat. They had him, see. My gosh.
How much money was taken that time? Do you remember, Patty?
I think it's $35,000.
$35,000.
Yeah. That's what they admitted that found, anyway. But there was two small preachers there, get being preachers there, that there was something like $16,000 or something, but they never admitted getting an opening door that they started in Burnham or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was quite a case. And you know, when you were before the commissioners in hearing in Platt, after they come in, Sheldon was telling his story, you know, how he brought the stuff into from his rotors up into Iditarod, and he brought it folded up in magazines, and he got into George Adams' roadhouse then in our hotel in Iditarod. And he threw the whole damn thing into the table there, in the pool table. And played cards there. And then went out to flat and buried it in tobacco cans. He was a gardener for Henry Durand then, see. And he buried it in tobacco cans there. So they divided it, see. Then he went outside, and after he went outside, when he had his spent, he wanted to borrow some money from Nellie, and she wouldn't go for it. So he spilled the beans then. I guess somebody was on his trail anyway. There was some woman mixed up outside.
Did you keep a dog team yourself, Patty?
Oh yeah.
Did you ever make the trip from Flat over to the Yukon River to Ruby in the wintertime?
Oh, I did two winters. One after three winters.
Three winters.
Yeah. I walked one winter though.
Walked over.
Oh yeah, because I had a dog team the next year or two. Well, yeah, I had a big dog. I used to keep 13 dogs. Class them too.
We kept a big team too.
Yeah.
Around 21.
There isn't many teams now except along the Yukon. There are quite a few, I guess, yet. Small teams now, though.
Well, in those days, that was the only mode of travel, was the old dog team.
The only mode of travel. But, of course, you can't stop progress. But it was the country was in better shape then, because there was an awful lot of activity along the Yukon, such as fishing,
roadhouses,
and a lot of travel in the winter. And those dogs had to be fed, and the fish, and their money kept in circulation, stayed in the country.
Stayed
see.
Right there, yeah.
Yeah. Sure did.
Did you ever do any drift work, Patty, over in the Iditarod?
Mm-mm.
You never did any drift
Mm-mm.
work?
No, I worked in the drifts here in Ruby.
But you never did any drift mining?
No, not myself, no.
No. I did all open
cuts. All open cuts, yeah.
Well, I can remember the old drift mining method because that's all we had around the Ruby.
That's all, yeah.
I was a boy.
Yeah. You must have worked in the drifts, huh?
I did, yeah. When I, you know, got to be a man.
Yeah, oh yeah. It's no place for a kid anyway.
Yeah.
You had to be a man too. No fool.
Lay back your ears and bray like a mule and go.
Yeah. That's all. You had to be a man.
Candlelight.
Candlelight, yeah.
All candlelight.
Slip down to your underwear too.
Yeah.
But it's funny, underground, it was nice work to me.
Yeah, warm underground.
Yeah.
A little chilly when you'd first go down. But
oh, yes. Yeah,
warm up.
But there are some places where you had those low drifts, it was pretty tough, you know.
Yeah, pretty tough, yeah. The only place you could straighten up is when you'd come into the shaft.
Onto the shaft, yes.
And they had the old steel wheel. They never had the rubber-tired buggy in those
days. Oh, God,
no,
no, no, no. I didn't know what rubber was those days. No, sir. You know, that's a wonderful addition to the wheel water, tire
wheel,
see. The rubber wheel.
Sure, when you get the old wheel off the wheeling plank, in the muffler, you'd have to lift her on. You couldn't wheel her on.
Oh, no.
You'd have to go around the front end of the wheel there and lift her back on.
Well, the rubber-tired wheel bar was a labor saver.
She just walked right along, you know, with a small... There was something like a balloon tire that the automobiles used to came out with at one time. Only they were small for a wheelbarrow. Low inflation, you know, not much air pressure. Yeah, but they were good, good rig. They'd wheel right along in the dirt with those, you know, no trouble at all.
No trouble then. I got to know it is. Of course, it's all done away with now. There's no wheelbarrow work anymore.
No.
Yeah, no wheelbarrow work.
Stop in a minute.
Huh? Yeah,
stop
in
a minute.
To a flat.
Oh, and quite a number. We have...
Was that Star Airlines?
The Pan American almost, the same, it turned over to the wind over to the Pan American after the first plane that was going into flap.
When they took the mail contract?
Yeah. No, the first going into flap, there was Neenan and that great big red-headed fellow, what the heck was that his name was? Dorband,
Frank Dorband.
Yeah. And
Barney Barnhill.
Barnhill. Mm-hmm. And what is that known, the other fellow?
Bennett?
Bennett, yeah.
Bennett. Yeah.
I guess Bennett is still flying.
Yeah, Bennett and Dorband and Barnhill were three really
yeah.
Bush pilots.
Yeah, the other Bush pilots, yeah.
Yeah.
They were good men, too.
Yeah, good flyers.
Good flyers.
Good
yeah.
drinkers.
Good drinkers.
Yeah. Yeah, all three of them.
All three of them, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they it was quite a list, all right, for travel, you know, when they want to leave on the fall and go so and get out, it was nice to be able to get on the plane. If it did cost, it was better than walking. If you had to walk to Seattle, it cost you almost as much, you know.
Now, how did the mail come in, Patty, into flat, in the early days of flat?
Oh, it is from by dock team.
Yeah, but which direction? Did it come in from Fairbanks? And
from Fairbanks, yeah.
Came from Fairbanks down the river.
Down the river to here, to Ruby.
To Ruby, and
yeah.
Then from Ruby, well, it went over the...
From here to Ruby, and from there to...
Long Creek, and Poor Man, and Cripple,
and McGrath,
and
Ophir, and Flat.
And Flat.
Then after a while, it came over right the other way from Toledo, and from... From the railroad, you know. From
in later years, it came from Nenana.
Yeah, from Nenana. From Nenana, yeah.
Like Manchumina.
Then after that, it came from sort of that place along the road. Closer to Anchorage, see. What the heck is that, the name of the place? It burned down a couple of years ago. A few years ago.
Between here and Anchorage?
Yeah.
Curry Hotel.
Curry. Curry, yeah, that's
it was
right.
It's called Dead Horse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Curry,
that
yeah. Curry.
Yeah.
You know, and then what I call Coke Hill had the contract.
Yeah, E. Coke Hill, later judge of the 4th Division.
Yeah.
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 He carried mail and he also raced dogs in Nome in the early days. Coke.
Yeah. Is he still living?
Coke's still living in San Francisco.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I know he was a year ago because he used to send the Pioneer Actions parties down there, conventions. And that's the Yukon Pioneers.
Yeah.
And the Saldo Club.
What characters now, and characters in name did you have around Flat? Now we had the Dago Kid in Ruby, and we had the Scurvy Kid.
We didn't have...
you remember the Dago Kid?
Yeah, the Dago Kid.
Brown?
Yeah.
You knew the Scurvy Kid?
The Scurvy Kid, yeah.
Yeah.
And we had another, what is that fellow that was that sort of with those fellows up the Kaikook?
Sam Dubin
nope.
Was a trader.
Oh, what is it? Like some kid or another that doesn't. He got away anyway. I don't think he ever been located.
Up in the.
In the Kaikuk.
In the Kaikuk.
Yeah.
And there was the Blueberry Kid.
The Blueberry Kid,
the
yeah.
The Blueberry Kid.
Yeah, that's
he was
right.
The one, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, the Blueberry Kid.
That's right.
He was the one who was supposed to have committed those murders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very likely because he made his getaway.
Yeah. Both would kill two brothers. Yeah. Up in the car show.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
And there was the Dirty Gertie. The black bear and the silly. They're all Alaska characters too.
Well, there was hardly any of those in my river that I know of, you know.
This is end of part one of the tape of Patrick Savage for Pioneer Igloo 4 at Fairbanks, Alaska, November the 5th, 1960, being recorded by Harry Hughes.
Yeah.
There you are, Patty.
I'll turn the tape over. See, that's just a half hour. We get 1 hour on both sides. You see, I take these off and turn them over, Patty? These infernal machines, as Crawford said. You know, Patty, up at the hospital, I took it up there last spring when the Pioneers first bought it, and I would take these recordings from the old Pioneers in the hospital, and I'd play them back to it, so they could hear them. And it was worth more just to play it back than it was to take it. They'd really got an enjoyment out of hearing it back. Even old Harry Badger did. And Napoleon and Dogface Sam and Columbo. There's dozens of them, you see.
Who is Napoleon now? Is he?
He's here in town. He's still going to grill with some friend of his.
Oh, boy.
Somebody give him money to get back out of Sitka and he come back. But I thought that it was worth it just for the enjoyment that they got out of hearing it.
Well, here's a good look.
I'll have to turn this one over, too.
Oh.
That's all right. We just set on the string there a little bit.
I'm trying to think.
This is the second half of the story from Patrick Savage. And Mr. Tom Long in Tom Long's home here in Fairbanks. Go ahead and talk.
You know, there were three big dog racing centers, Patty. There was Nome in the early days, there was Ruby, and there was the Iditarod races.
Yeah.
Now, in Ruby, they used to race from Ruby
to Long
Creek and return.
And back, yeah.
Now, where did they race in the Iditarod? It was
a short distance from flat to Iditarod back.
Yeah, you remember the Going Kid.
Oh, yeah, the Going Kid, yeah.
Yeah.
Going Kid won the best time that was ever made there, I guess.
On that course, the Going Kid. He also raced up in the pass in Canada, too.
And he raced here from Iditarod, from Ruby to Long.
To Long, yeah, he was in those races all the time, yeah.
And he was club footed, you know.
And,
but he
Seppala,
was.
Seppala used to go on those races, too.
Yeah. Yeah, he won quite a race in Long, you know. And he was there for quite a while, you know, before the race practicing.
Yeah.
And they were there with a lot of money he bet on him.
A lot of money, yeah.
And he was, he'd be out, he'd make it, drive the mile, and then he'd come back, and they'd be watching, and then he'd go 2 miles and come back, and then another time he'd go 4 miles and come back. And they were after him all the time, see? And of course he knew what he could do, all right.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the winning race, he said he bet that he'd beat his own time 5 minutes. Nobody would take him up.
Now the Going Kid was a young man, but he was club-footed. And
club-footed.
He had to ride practically all the time.
Yeah,
all
right, yeah.
Yeah, I knew him well.
But he bred his own dogs, you know, and he really had good dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And he made it made a speciality of having him 1/3 Llewellyn setter and 2/3 Malamute.
Malamute.
And he wouldn't have any dog that wouldn't take the black snake.
Wouldn't use a whip.
Yeah. If they wouldn't take the whip, he wouldn't use them.
He used a whip. He drove with the whip. That's the way they used to drive it. in the early days. They had a long silk popper on the end of the leather whip, which was braided. This silk was braided, I'd say about 8 or 9 inches long. Braided silk. And that's what cracked. That's also what cut. Because when they'd reach out and crack that whip, where the silk popper would pop.
Yeah, and a dog would get scared to look back at him where he'd discard that dog. He wouldn't have it. The dog had to be able to take that whip and go and look and not get afraid either, you know. Oh, he was a man, that fellow, some musher.
Who was the mail carrier in the early days over there from Ruby over,
Patty, that you remember?
Oh, Ben Derrick and Scotty Clark.
And Fred Milligan, probably.
Milligan, they were going to, they were going to Fairbanks, Milligan and Burke.
Bill Burke. And the mail used to come in just as regular as it did by airplane, only more so. Twice a week. That's what it came into Ruby.
Twice a week too,
twice
yeah.
Twice a week to Ruby.
Well, it didn't come down so often until I did run to flat.
And they'd come in, rain, shine, snow, or whatever it was.
Well, we used to get mail down there every 2 weeks.
I've seen the mail come into Ruby when they had 21 dogs and 4 men out snowshoeing the head of the dogs.
Oh, yes. Yes.
But the mail had come in on time.
Oh, they were generally in time, all right.
The 800-pound load limit they had on the Yukon River and 600 pounds cross-country.
Of course, from Ruby to...
load limit.
From Ruby, they went to Ophir and met McGrath and Ophir and met the other teams there, transferred there, see.
And they rode the skis and the G-pole, or the Ouija board.
The Ouija board is
Ouija
right.
Ouija board.
What the heck?
Explain that Ouija board. There's many people
well,
ask that.
The Ouija board, a man on skis, you've got one section of tow line with no dogs. In other words, the wheel dogs are set ahead from the front end of the sled, one section, which is allowed for two dogs. But the man stands there on skis, and he holds the G-pole to guide a heavily loaded sled, long sled, or otherwise the sled wouldn't stay on the trail. So he either stands on the skis and holds the G-pole, or he could sit down on the bow of the sled and guide with his body and with the skis. And the Ouija board was hooked into, with the prow of the Ouija board, was hooked into the tow line itself. The man's skis were on his feet, just on his feet, not attached to the tow line. But a Ouija board is attached to the tow line. In other words, a man stood on the Ouija board, just stood on it. It was like a miniature toboggan is what it was like. And he'd stand on the Ouija board, or he could get off the Ouija board, off and on, if he wanted to. But the Ouija board put more pull on the dogs than skis do, for the simple reason that a man on skis can help going uphill. He can walk on skis. A man on a Ouija board, why, he was a dead weight riding on the Ouija board. See what I mean? Yeah, it'd be that much more of a pull for the dogs. But the Ouija board was attached to the main tow line itself. And then they had a rough lock, like a man who's driving 16, 18 dogs, and he's riding on skis in the front end of the sled. He's got no one on the brake on the back end of the sled. He's got a 600 or 800 pound load in the sled. He's got a heavy load going downhill where the sled had gained momentum and maybe run over the dogs or run over him. So he had a rough lock, a chain on the front end hanging on the G-pole that he'd dropped down underneath the runner of the sled and put the rough lock on, and that'd hold the sled back going downhill. Patty remembers
exactly.
That.
Oh, yes, you betcha. But I guess you get off that, and for a while, and then get on again, the dogs look back at you. That knows the difference. That knows the difference of the pool. Some people say, you better get off there. Oh, dogs are smart, boy. They used to dive, they're going to kill you, used to dive 21 dogs.
21 dogs, yeah.
Pete was a nice team because he'd go, you
16 dogs was an ordinary team in those
yeah,
days.
Yeah, yeah.
Not an uncommon team at all. I first started driving dogs when I was about seven years old.
You were all right.
We had five dogs.
You were raised in the Yukon,
raised,
you
know? Raised yeah. on the Yukon.
Yeah.
River. I remember the country before the day of the railroad, before the day of the airplane. We both do.
Yeah. Well, it's nice not to hop into an airplane and reach old Fairbanks and so many of those places in an hour or two. From Flats, we can reach Fairbanks in 2.5 hours, you know.
Yeah, I took census the winter of 1939-40, and that was in fairly late years.
Yeah.
And I traveled 1,200 miles by dog team and enumerated 200 people. Nothing but trappers and prospectors.
Yeah, out in the hills, yes.
Out in the hills. I traveled 5 days for one man alone.
You didn't have trails all the time,
no
either.
No trails. Get out and go on the snowshoes.
That was rough, all right.
And I had a tent and a stove with me and my own food and my own dog feed. And I put up my tent at night and feed my dogs.
It was not very pleasant, but
no.
It had to be done.
It had to be done, yeah. It's the only way you could travel.
The only way you could travel, yeah.
Either that or off on the 2 feet that you had to travel on.
Did you use radio?
Huh?
Well, not in the earlier days. No, well, radio first came, got fairly prevalent in Alaska. First, I'd say about, in the early 20s.
That would be about it,
yeah,
all right.
In the early 20s.
Yeah, that would be about it.
Say about 23, 22, 24, or somewhere around in there.
Yes, around there. But then
we had these battery radios.
Then you had to have earphones to get anything over.
Now, in the radios that we had, there were these dry cell batteries, big dry cell batteries. And you erected a big high antenna. Big high antenna. You could not only get Fairbanks, but you could get all the foreign stations too. You could get Big Ben striking in London. You could get the Japanese stations. You could get all the foreign stations. Well, you can't get them in here in Fairbanks. But you can get them out in the sticks. The foreign stations come in over those dry cell radios. But they have big high antennas too. Put up a big aerial. Oh yeah, with home there, we used to get all that.
Well, you had to be careful where high to get over the hills a little, see? If you were down in a valley closed in, valley, you wouldn't get such service.
Yeah, we had a big high antenna all the time.
Of course, Ruby's fairly high at that, you know.
Yeah.
Quite a bit over the river.
Yeah.
Well, those days are gone now. You can get radio and you don't have to have hardly any antenna.
Were you in Fairbanks in the early days at all, Patty?
Mm-mm.
No.
No, I wasn't in Fairbanks until, I believe, in 32 was the first time I seen Fairbanks.
In 32?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. 32. See, I was for 8 years from the country without ever leaving it.
Yeah, when you knew my dad when he'd make trips
the
flat, he'd make trips by dog team to the Iditarod sometimes, by dog team.
Well, that was in government.
Government work,
yeah.
Yeah, he'd pick up a prisoner in Flat or the Iditarod and bring him by dog team all the way to Fairbanks.
All the way to Fairbanks, yeah.
All the way to Fairbanks. I remember one time he brought an insane person from the Iditarod all the way to Fairbanks. A dog team.
That was your father?
My father.
And what was his name?
Tom Long.
Tom Long was United States Marshal.
Deputy Marshal in Ruby, Alaska. And my uncle John Long was the first commissioner of Fairbanks, Alaska.
Is that so?
Yeah, John Long, yeah. Three brothers came into the country together.
There
John
still,
Long, John Long, and Les Long.
There is still a John Long in Fairbanks
here. He's not related to us, though.
No, he's not.
No. John Long passed away a long time ago.
No, your father.
My dad came in. My dad and two brothers came into Dawson in 1898. And my father and John Long stayed in the country, and Les Long stayed one winter and went back out.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad went outside in 1901 or 1902, and he married my mother in Salt Lake City, Utah. And they went to the Philippine Islands. That's where my brother was born.
Uh-huh.
In the government service. And my mother taught school there. Then in 1905, I was born on the Isthmus of Panama, Ancon.
Boy.
And came to Alaska. Returned to Alaska, my dad did, in 1911. And went to Ruby in 1912.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
My mother and brother and I came into the country in 1915. And came to Ruby, by the way of Dawson. And down the Yukon River by
boat.
Yeah,
don't
all the way down by boat.
Well, it was a nice trip.
A nice trip.
It was a nice trip, yeah. Got good boats those days, you know.
Patty, how large a nugget was that nugget that you gave the University of Alaska?
Well, I didn't give it to the
University. Well, that they bought from you, is that it?
No, they took some pictures of it. It was 34 and a half ounces.
So, well, what have it? They just on display out there? Is that
yeah, it? Yeah. Oh, no. No, I sold it to a fellow in Galena here about 2 years ago.
Oh. How many ounces was it?
34 and a half.
34 and a half ounce nugget.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A beautiful one, too.
Yeah.
It was just built like a mountain, you know.
Yeah.
Ridges in it, this was a beautiful nugget. I had no right to sell it to you, but I needed the money then.
Yeah.
I got $70 an ounce for it.
For that nugget.
For that nugget, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good price for a nugget, too. Double the value.
Yeah. That's the largest nugget you ever...
Oh, yes, that's the largest. I've seen larger than that, yes.
Yeah, but I mean that you ever mined yourself.
Yeah, that's the largest,
34 and a half ounces.
34 and a half, yeah.
Yeah.
There weren't very many larger than that found in Alaska. Of course, there was one great big nugget found in Nome years ago. Mm. And there was one found in Ruby in 1914. In the Mascot Bench.
The Mascot Bench, yeah.
Yeah. That's a Norton Long piece.
Well, that
and
was
that good. Was... Exactly according to the value of it was $1,914, a dollar for every year. That was why I remember it so well. It was by Walker and Dietz.
Walker and Dietz.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shelf and Walker and Dietz have three in the operations.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a beautiful nugget too.
Was that Bert Walker?
Bert Walker, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful nugget because and I was a cheechalker in the country then. And
Bert Walker blew himself up in the Mascot.
He did after, yeah. I happened to go into Husky's saloon there, see?
Yeah, Charlie Husky.
Charlie Husky.
Mm-hmm.
And Bert was displaying it, you know. And I happened to go in, he says, Paddy, he says, I happened to know him for a few months before that. He says, you want to see a big, good nugget? And I went over and I held out my hand like that, see? And he raised his hand up about a foot and a half and let it drop and banged my fingers against the counter, you know. That was a trick he used to do that, and I was a street chalker.
Oh.
And he raised it clearly out of and then I would hold your hand just almost to top of the, you know, top of
mm-hmm.
the counter.
Yes.
Why did I jump and then that hit my fingers, you know. And that's what he said it was at 19-something ounces what it was worth right then, see.
Yeah.
And he said it was exactly, according to the weight, $1,914 then at that price of the old price of gold. So that was a good size nugget, all right.
Yeah. Well, what would the Long Creek gold that you mined there running out, Patty, at the new price?
At the new price, well, I mean, your 1,000 fines from the, as it comes out.
Yeah, as is. What?
About $30 an ounce.
About $30 an ounce.
Yeah. $30 an ounce. Mm-hmm. And before that, I guess before
that's
that, it was about 18 or something. Huh?
That's good gold.
It is all very good gold, yeah. It's good gold.
Yeah.
If you had lessons, it would be fine.
Yeah.
Lessons, of course, that's especially.
Yeah.
You know, they found this Magnuson Indian Ophir Ristich, he found a 60, I think it's 60 ounce nugget, or 65 this summer.
This summer?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And he found that, according to what I understand, right almost on top of the gravel. He's in town right now, too.
He didn't go through the boxes at all.
I guess not.
He found it in the cut.
Found it in the cut, I guess, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And he found a few large, he found a 10-ounce nugget, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. He's in town, and now I saw him today. He and Tybo Rosander and Tybo's wife, the Rosander's there in town. He came in with, I think he brought Tybo in.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a plane, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if I see him, I'm going to find out from him.
Yeah.
But I think he may be here for a day or two. And it's funny, nobody knows where he found the nugget here, you know, but he was mining in Little Creek there, in a little side stream into the, mm-hmm. On the high benches of the Anoka.
Mm-hmm.
Not the Anoka, but Gaines Creek. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Tributary of the Anoka.
Yeah.
Right by the dredge almost, but on the bench.
Well, the Gooms had a dredge in flat, didn't they?
Oh yeah, that's there yet.
That's there yet.
It's operating. The Miskiewicz is operating it now.
The old Guggenheim dredge.
The old Guggenheim dredge,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. The Riley Investment Company dredge.
Oh, Riley Investment.
That was dismantled, the Guggenheim dredge was dismantled.
Mm-hmm. That was on flat itself?
On flat, yeah.
Yeah. What were the best producing creeks in that area there? There was Flat and Otter?
Well, Otter Creek produced the most, yeah.
Otter Creek.
Yeah. Of course, there was richer ground by claim and by some claims in Flat Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And then Marietta was awful rich, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They took $1 million out of it 1 year there.
Yeah.
And they're still producing.
Yeah, did you know about Jack Shropshire when he was over there in the Iditarod too?
Yeah. Well, but I did realize damn near done now. A few years more, 3 or 4 years, I think it's clean.
Gone, yeah.
Looks very much like it now.
Mm-hmm.
But, as I say, when I went in there, it was supposed to be done right then.
Done then, yeah.
The camp was worked out.
Yeah.
That was in 15.
Same way with Ruby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ruby's going down too. Ruby's going to produce a lot of gold yet.
Ruby will produce a lot of gold yet.
Yeah.
If the price of gold had come up, it'd help a lot too.
Well, if it don't come up, you know, I think it looks very likely that it'll have to someday in the near future, maybe in the course of 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, Birch Creek should produce some. Trail Creek.
Birch Creek will produce anyway.
Yeah.
There are several creeks, there are a dozen creeks around Ruby. There is Well,
two
there is
them, four man too, for that matter.
There is Schmidt, and there is Pullman, and there is
Tim
Burns, Flat Creek yet, that'll be
Flat Creek yet.
Of course, I think there is ground on Flat Creek, the Whiskey Witch thing, too, there is some ground left, and we'll say as it is.
Tamarack,
yes. And Quartz Creek, maybe if the price is holding up, there's a possible chance that Quartz Creek could be checked. Because I found some fair value there and didn't do any work to speak of.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Flint.
Flint.
Also.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the Ruby District has produced a lot of gold, too.
A lot of gold, yeah.
A lot of gold.
Yeah, it's produced a lot of gold, is right.
Did you marry up in this country, Patty?
Who?
You, did you get married up here in Alaska?
Oh, yeah.
You met your wife here in Alaska?
Yeah.
Where, in Flat?
In Flat, yeah.
In Flat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was school teacher.
Teaching school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She was from Nebraska.
Nebraska.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you weren't born in Ireland, though, were you, Patty?
Oh, yes.
Well, you were, how old were you when you came over then?
25, about 25 from Ireland, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was so far in my 25th year, all right. And you know, you're not a baby if you're 25.
Yeah. Well, there's quite a few men from Ireland up here in this country.
Yeah. They won't look like any other.
Like how many miles running. Would you say it is from the Fairbanks area here to the flat?
About 380.
About 380 miles?
Yeah.
That's airline miles.
Yeah, well, I think so, yes.
Yeah. But by dog team, it's a long ways far.
Oh, yes, yes. It's I guess dang near 100 miles further.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, by dog team in the early days, it'd take how many days from Fairbanks here, Patty, do you think?
How many days from Fairbanks to?
Yeah, to Flat. Going by Ruby. And I can tell you how many days
could
from
be,
here.
Could be
go for about 8 days.
Could be at least
9 days.
Could be at least 15 days.
About 15 days.
See, from Gopher, could take at least 3 days to Flat.
From Flat to Ophir, about 3 days.
At least, yes.
And from Ophir to Ruby, 4 days.
Yeah.
That's 7 days. Yeah.
That's in good traveling.
Yeah,
about
15 days, dog team travel. Yeah.
Yeah, we used to get mail at that time only twice a week, you know. Or every 2 weeks, I mean. Twice a month.
Up the time yet, though.
About 6 minutes, 5 minutes. Mm-hmm.
Say, Patty, I want you to read this poem of yours that you dedicated to the pioneers.
I never saw it.
Huh?
I never saw it.
Read it.
By Patrick Savage.
By Patrick Savage.
Dedicated.
Read it so it'll be
loud. Poem to the pioneers. Yeah. You didn't say pioneers of Alaska either. Now 78 years old and long-time Alaska miner, he's in Fairbanks until Friday when he will head for his seventh mining season at his diggings in Long Creek, near Ruby. Irish born in Kerry County, Pat migrated to the United States in 1907, came to Alaska in 1914. He mined in the Flat District for many years. He spent last winter in Seattle, California, where he wrote a little poem that he dedicated to the pioneers of Alaska. Oh, that's he. I love the old Alaska, the largest state of all. I love it in the winter, summer, spring, and in the fall. I love the smoke-clad vastness with evergreen timber tall, and towering Mount McKinley, the monarch of them all. There, the mighty River Yukon swells the angry Bering Sea, and her 6 months perpetual daylight is a dream of dreams to me. She has unexplored dominions with potentials by the score, and undeveloped minerals with ever open door. Her scenery incomparable in superlative degree, and if you have seen Alaska, you will agree with me. I have trod her hills and valleys, I have panned her winding streams, from the Stikine to the Arctic, have subdued my better dreams. I have toiled and mined for riches, in quest of precious gold, and my pioneer friends well know, still I love to live forever. I think there's a mistake in this, where the Yukon River flows. I have toiled and mined for riches, in quest of precious gold. As my pioneer friends well know, that doesn't work very well, still I love to live forever, where the Yukon River flows. I have toiled and mined for riches, as my pioneer friends well know, still I'd love to live forever for the Yukon River flows. That's how it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the first time I've seen it in print.
Would you care if the pioneers put it to music?
Oh, not at all.
Huh?
Not at all. Yeah.
Put it on, make your statement on the tape that you wish the pioneers are given the opportunity to make the music if they wish.
I give the pioneer the opportunity to join and I want to meet it.
Okay, Patty. It is done.
But no, that last few words there doesn't seem right to me. I've toiled the mine for riches in quest of precious gold. Still, I'd love to live forever for the Yukon River flood. I think that could leave out the pioneer's friends well known there. Don't you think?
Well, whoever writes it to music will make it rhyme.
Yeah.
But it's your saying, and that's what they want the authorization to use.
Oh, it does have my authorization.
Mm-hmm.
I got a few lines that I'm going to dedicate to I wrote it years ago, 2 years ago. I wrote this to you after they'd become a state.
Mm-hmm. You wrote that?
Yeah.
Right after it became a state?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In January, about the 17th of January.
Uh-huh.
17th of January, 59, is when I wrote it.
January 59, yes.
Yeah. Another little catchy thing for the that I was going to give to the scouts, the Boy Scouts.
Mm-hmm.
It's hip hip hooray for Alaska, the largest state of all. I don't know if I can think of it now. Hip hooray for Alaska, the largest state of all. I guess I know. If I can think of that.
Well, we'll have to terminate this tape very shortly, so this is a Pioneer Igloo number 4, Fairbanks, Alaska recording, taken by Harry Hughes at Mr. Tom Long's residence in Fairbanks, and we'll introduce each person present here to witness the tape. Patrick Savage first. Your full name on the tape.
Patrick Savage.
Tom Long.
Ruby Hughes. Mary Long.
And that's the end of this tape.
Oh, what?
Get your name on there, honey.
Marnie Long.
Say it nice so we can hear it.
Marnie Long.
Marnie Long?
Mm-hmm.
How old are you, Marnie?
7
years old, and you was born here in Fairbanks. That's the end of this tape. I'll put a new roll on it then.
Jenny wants to play a little tune.
I'll put it on a...